You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Soupcast, coming to you from ArchaeoSoup Towers. By popular demand, we're taking selected videos from the ArchaeoSoup back catalogue and bringing them to you as convenient podcasts. As the name implies, with ArchaeoSoup, you get a bit of everything thrown into the pot. Archaeology, discussion, humour and debate. You can find out more at archaeosoup.com. So sit back, relax and enjoy a hearty helping of ArchaeoSoup. Welcome back to Watching Brief for the week of the 9th of August, 2021. I am joined today by my slightly depressed co-host, Mr. Andy Brockman. Good afternoon, Andy.
Good afternoon. The sun's actually shining outside. It's beautiful here. But then if I'm slightly depressed, it's because I've been reading the background material about our first item.
Climate change or not, our watching brief does continue, and this week we are here to, as ever, examine the archaeological news of the week and present it here for you to discuss and augment below with your opinion and conversation. And we're going to start this week's watching brief with the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report that was published by the UN. That makes for grim reading. And the reason why we're doing this is because climate is everything. Climate is the context, in this instance, or in terms of our purview, of archaeological monuments and sites. It's our ability to visit them, our ability to study them, our ability to look after them. And there's one particularly poignant story that really highlights that we are in a moment of change that we haven't seen the likes of, well, in this instance, actually, for the past 2,500 years in this particular story. But I'll come to that in a moment. I suppose, first and foremost, what are the broad strokes? I mean, you were just saying that the summary alone of the IPCC report is 46 pages. But before we go on to talk about what archaeologists and heritage sector people should be thinking about or could be thinking about when it comes to climate change, what are the headlines?
Well, as you said, I mean, this is not something that's easy to reduce to headlines because it's a science-based report. It's thousands of pages of data-driven evidence and conclusions. As I said, as you just said, the summary, what's called the summary for policymakers, is over 40 pages. Mm. You compare that to the short paragraph you get as an abstract at the end of your average academic article. We're dealing with a very, very weighty, very serious piece of work here. Mm-hmm. The headline is basically that the estimate is that there's around 12 years to keep global warming down to around 1.5 degrees above what we have at the moment. That is reckoned to be the maximum that the planet can take without significantly higher risks of drought, of floods, extreme heat, which, you know, in and of itself can be fatal for plants, animals, humans, and the economic consequences of that, which could be, you know, poverty and drought and famine for potentially hundreds of millions of our fellow human beings. Yeah. This is about as serious as it gets in international policy making. The UN uses language like urgent, unprecedented, but they say, you know, that with urgent action, which they also argue is affordable and feasible, that the damage can be kept to a minimum, that the people might have heard of the Paris Accords, which pledged to keep temperatures down from rising between 1.5 and 2 degrees. They argue that that's done, but it requires urgent action within the next dozen years at most, starting now, effectively. Yeah. We now
Starting
added to this.
yesterday.
Well, yeah, exactly. And we add to this the so-called COP26 conference in Glasgow, which is being hosted by the UK government, which is coming up in the autumn, which is expected to come up with concrete proposals, particularly for the most significant economic powers, Europe, US, Russia, China, India, the most significantly, it has to be said, polluting powers, the most significant. This is one of those issues where it's industrialized societies that tend to put carbon into the atmosphere, which is what is seen as the root cause of this. But the worst consequences are being wreaked on perhaps the least industrialized, the most vulnerable societies, the ones that are still, the ones that either are on the margins of the oceans, and particularly the Pacific and Indian Ocean, and also the sub-Saharan Africa, countries that still rely a lot on subsistence agriculture and so on, which is very vulnerable to relatively small changes in climate, relatively less rain and relatively more heat, and you can havoc can be wreaked in a very short period of time.
Yeah, well, in that sense, it's so multifaceted, it's really hard to hold in your head at once. And this is arguably one of the reasons why it seemingly no one really tries. This is why they have hundreds and thousands of specialists working on all of this at the same time. But things, for example, like encroaching desertification, is a very dangerous process in certain parts of the world where it's extremely hard, if not impossible, to reverse that process once it gets going. It's been described as a code red for humanity, something that we absolutely have to act on. And I suppose just from a sort of a historical perspective, something which I would mention is that often in these conversations, I have colleagues, and people who I have worked with in the past, who when it comes to issues, for example, surrounding things like recycling or the end, what's called the end user's effect, that I've heard people say things like, "Well, why should I do anything when China is still insert overblown statement," when actually China's also doing a lot to invest in green energy. Again, it's a complex issue, and the simple answer is you should do it, first of all, because it's the right thing to do for the species at this stage, as I say, code red for humanity. But also, secondly, actually, I mean, I know you're saying the worst polluters now are those countries that you listed, but the UK has a role to play in its historic founding nature of this problem, or certainly at the exacerbation of this problem. I mean, we can see in ice cores when the Roman Empire started smelting lead, for example, on a massive scale. But the British Industrial Revolution, something which in other sectors of society and conversation, and for example in the history and national curriculum we're very proud of, is something that we also have to be aware of and take responsibility for. We exported this globally, and so in that sense, that's another reason why particularly British friends and colleagues should take a little bit of responsibility. So do what you can when you can, and then that's more or less that's my little thing there. That also doesn't mean that we can do everything. So, for example, we still have a van, that is a diesel vehicle. We're thinking of ways to mitigate that, but it doesn't mean that you can change everything overnight, but what you can when you can. But anyway, but how can this relate more broadly then to the archaeological sector? What should and could and will the heritage sector have to take into account in the near future? I mean, one thing that comes to mind is just the so many of our monuments and archaeological sites of interest are outdoors. They are exposed to the environment, and presumably there's going to be matters arising linked with erosion and preservation and the stability of monuments. For example, on the Scottish coast, we're seeing an increased rate of erosion due to an increased ferocity in seasonal storms, which are eroding away hitherto relatively stable middens and exposed multi-layered archaeological sites on the islands. I mean, that's just one issue.
The other thing that leaps off this particular summary of possibilities, probabilities, most of these are stated with what's called scientific high confidence, is strong decline in glacier, permafrost, and snow cover extent and seasonal snow duration at high altitudes. And then these will be continuing again through that period. And again, that's stated with high confidence. Now, we've already seen reports, for example, from Norway of the retreat of glaciers and the recovery of European Iron Age artifacts. People would be very familiar with Ötzi, who was found on the Italian, I think it was the Italian-Austrian border, the so-called Iceman. Instances like that will become more common. Now, if you look at the resources that were thrown at one single incident like Ötzi, then imagine multiply that by many, many more times and look at the resources that the archaeological world would need to throw at some unique archaeology that might be emerging. And is it capable of actually handling that amount of work?
So the retreating context of archaeology in the context of previously stable cold environments and the need to recover that material before it's lost permanently, ha having been exposed to a new environment, the need to monitor things like in the southeast of England, you were saying yesterday, in the context of places like Flag Fen, where changes in water levels, changes in salinity, acidity, oxygenation, all these things that come about when this balance is altered will change the need to either save archaeology in the con and also in the context of, for example, of storms, as I've mentioned in Scotland, in terms of rescue archaeology, but also it will put previously stable sites at risk of erosion, or otherwise being chemically dissolved in some cases. That's one aspect, the recovery of archaeology. But the other one as well is a big part of our sector, and that is the context in which this material is often seen and displayed, in the context of building and development projects surrounding, in particular, museums. The big attractive, dare I say it, even slightly vain notion that we need to build in every case a new wing to a museum or a new entire interior to a building, or we need to reimagine the exterior of a building in order to recontextualize material in a museum, is surely something that's not sustainable. Now, I recognize that some older buildings are less environmentally sound in so much as they do allow heat to escape. And it's less, I suppose, less of a headline grabber to say, well, we've installed lots of insulation in the local museum. It's much more interesting to say, we've built a new museum that's got all this wonderful new green technology. That is a problem, in so much as the architects and planning sector are suggesting that we need to be rethinking how we reuse and repurpose as opposed to knock down and rebuild. I mean, what else? So we've got the recovery of archaeology, we've got the context of the display of archaeology. Is there an argument to be made in terms of the way that we do archaeology on an international scale? Things like conferences, for example. Is that something? Do we need to reconsider whether or not we actually need to fly to Switzerland to deliver that keynote speech on, on Alpine archaeology, for example?
That's a very good point. And there was already a move just on grounds of cost, and the high cost of attending international conferences excludes probably more people than it includes. Particularly, early career academics, people who haven't got a huge amount of disposable income to spend, a couple of hundred or some more than a couple of hundred quid on flights, more again on hotels. Is that actually necessary? So that was already happening even before COVID, even before our new normal of life on Zoom and Skype and Teams. Those, these were essentially, these are things that individual agency can have effect on.
Yes.
I think there's a more fundamental thing, though, your archaeologists need to look at. You alluded to it with the idea we're talking about construction. There is a strong movement, certainly in UK architecture now, for the retrofitting of buildings rather than the wholesale demolition redevelopment of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason for that is in some figures which I'm quoting here from Joe Giddings, who's the campaigns director of the Architects Climate Action Network, who pointed out on Twitter in the wake of the report coming out. This is a graph of building sector carbon dioxide emissions in new construction in an estimate between 2015 and 2050. And the estimate is that within that period, the CO2 emissions of new construction, 90% come in the building materials phase, the phase when the building is actually being built, the old building's being demolished and the new building's being built, or even just the new buildings being built. 90% of the carbon emissions come within that short period. The actual operational life of the building is estimated to put into the atmosphere roughly 10% of the total CO2 that building will emit.
Right. Okay.
That is a pretty damning figure, and I think archaeologists have to ask themselves: do we just sit back and let the construction sector and architects and governments take the lead, or do we campaign by saying we don't want to work on new builds where it's avoidable? That the ethical position will be not to work on a new build if that new build is avoidable, if that new build involves the destruction of an old building that's perfectly possible to repurpose.
That's an interesting one. And also it's going to result in very difficult conversations. For example, here in the northeast in Newcastle, they are still actually completing a construction of various new hospital wings that were built on the footings of hospital buildings that were put in the late 1800s. So, and it was really interesting for me watching them come down, because you could see the cross section of these sort of Victorian and Georgian hospital wings from a distance. But the argument there was that the buildings couldn't be repurposed, that they were unsatisfactory in terms of, for example, provision of space for hospital beds, getting through doorways, installing lifts, modern standards when it comes to the provision of oxygen, for example, in the walls, electricity, and once again, things like insulation, etc. My understanding was that in that instance, the argument was made that there simply wasn't enough room in the building to make it as it should be, or as it could be. I suspect that these conversations will have to be presumably part of the planning process, I guess, won't they, in the build-up to new builds. And so archaeologists can be weighing up whether or not, as you say, that this is actually a necessary structure. It's interesting because, you know, on an archaeological timescale, this is definitely going to be viewable as well. I mean, people have talked about the so-called Anthropocene. According to this report, the damage that we're doing will already take effect for centuries, if not
indeed, absolutely. We are past the point of being able to turn back completely. Absolutely, yeah, that's what the report says.
I'm actually in this instance not going to try and find a positive, because I think it's important that we all reflect upon the seriousness of this. So normally I would say, so anything good that we can take from this report? Now a squirrel, water skiing. No, that's exactly what I'm not going to do. But what I will do...
A cute cat sitting on your computer. Yeah.
But what we will do is we'll link to the summary of the IPCC report below, along with various other useful resources. Also that Twitter link as well, with the that interesting graph. 90% at the beginning.
Can I just make one more point as well?
Yeah.
Which is very quickly, and people can please join the debate below the line, because there are probably few more crucial debates in the world now, let alone the world of archaeology, as to how we respond to the climate change emergency, as it's being christened, the Code Red, as the UN have called it, and they don't, they wouldn't use that kind of arguably inflammatory language lightly. You know, this is serious, serious stuff, about as serious as it gets. And if you're a member of an organisation like CIFA, like FAME, Federation of Archaeological Managers and Employers, like the Council for British Archaeology, if you're a member of English Heritage, you know, make your voice known to the people in charge. Tell them that they need to respond to this stuff, that they need a corporate policy, that they need to work together with other people in the sector. I'm not surprised, but before we started recording, I went through the social media feeds of CIFA, of FAME, of Council of British Archaeology, and leading representative bodies in the archaeological sector in England or in the UK. I haven't looked at Europe or the States, but I've just parochially looked at what's happening in the UK. Mm-hmm. And none of them mentioned the report or linked to the report. No. There is a global statement on climate change that was released in 2020, mm-hmm. but there's been no response so far from any of those organisations to what the UN published this week.
Okay. And I suppose I would just end on the note, the rather poignant point that I referred to right at the beginning, and that is the news from Evia, the Evia fires in Greece, that an ancient 2,500-year-old olive tree has now been burned to the ground. It is no more. 2,500-year-old ancient olive tree on the island of Evia was destroyed today in ongoing wildfires consuming the region. The ancient tree was located in the olive grove of Rovia and was such an enduring symbol of the landscape that the ancient geographer and philosopher Strabo featured it in his writings. This thing has seen the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, the rise of the modern world as we know it. One person even joked on Twitter the popularization, abandonment and repopularization of 70s fashion, and and now has gone. The world is changing, and the world that is changing is the context of what we do. And so, as you say, those bodies probably should have an opinion on climate change, in particular in response to this report.
Not an opinion. Actionable policies.
Our second story of the week is a response to an unfolding situation at a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Lalibela rock-hewn churches in Ethiopia, which have always fascinated me. I did a video on this site quite a while ago now, actually. Churches carved into the geology itself, buildings beautifully rendered in what the king who had the vision to make this place dubbed, and has since been also colloquially dubbed, the Second Jerusalem. It was a true vision of attempting to create a religious center in the heart of the Ethiopian kingdom. Has been seized, the town and the monument that contains it, that is contained within it, but has been seized by Tigrayan fighters. This has led to UNESCO issuing a statement of concern. UNESCO wishes to express its deep concern about the reports on the expansion of the conflict to the city of Lalibela, Ethiopia, which hosts the World Heritage Site of the Rock-Hewn Churches. UNESCO calls for respect of all relevant obligations under international law in ensuring the protection of the outstanding universal value and legacy of this precious site by refraining from any act that may expose it to damage, by taking all necessary precautions to prevent any attempts at looting, pillaging, and destruction, therefore, I suppose, of cultural properties located in the area. This is, of course, an ongoing place of pilgrimage and devotion, and has been since the 13th century, when this so-called New Jerusalem was founded. The reason why I'm interested in just highlighting this, and we can give it a little bit of context in terms of the conflict as well, because seemingly people are misunderstanding this. This is actually a direct response to, I'm not going to name the person, but someone on Archaeosuit Facebook who said, "Oh, it's fine, it's okay, it's fine. They're Christian warriors. They're also Christians. It's a Christian site. It, nothing's going to happen. It's fine. It's not like what happened, for example, at Timbuktu with Islamic State, for example, is the implication." And to which my immediate response is, "Well, Reformation, civil war, the list goes on. Just because people share a particular religious outlook doesn't mean that buildings and people don't suffer in these conflicts." And in this instance, the UNESCO report specifically mentions the risk of looting, because if you're fighting a civil war, you can make all sorts of excuses and reasons to loot a site and sell off those goods for the good of the cause. This yes, okay, we're gonna sell off this relic now, but we'll get something even better once we win the glorious revolution in the name of our whatever, political cause or faith, insert here. So, I suppose the real question is actually, what is the risk to Lalibela? And is UNESCO right to be concerned, do we think?
The short answer is obviously yes,
Mm.
because what is at risk in any area of instability? And we've seen the similar concerns expressed, for example, in the conflict in Yemen, which is ongoing still. And we're seeing a slow motion catastrophe in Afghanistan, almost certainly, whereby the people that brought you the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas and the museum and National Museum in Kabul, and also gave rise to another looting channel to the West and to Western collectors, are taking control of large parts of Afghanistan again. That's the Taliban. Other religions are available and also do this stuff, as you've just quite rightly pointed out. There's a different religious tradition in Ethiopia and in Tigray, which we're talking about. If I just say that, for example, anybody that studies trafficked antiquities knows that, for example, illuminated manuscripts from the medieval period in Ethiopia, gospels and that kind of thing, are extremely collectible. So you need to say no more. There's a real irony here in that the current round of conflict has been started overseen by Abiy Ahmed, who is the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, and as recently as 2019 won the Nobel Peace Prize for ending one of the previous civil conflicts in the country, and had arguably made a lot of political reforms. Unfortunately, the people in Tigray, which is in the north of Ethiopia, felt that those reforms were centralizing government to Addis Ababa, the capital, and leaving them out in the cold. They argued that the elections, the postponement of elections because of the coronavirus, was illegal, and effectively, that whole political conflict has precipitated the current physical conflict. And the problem is that the Tigrayans have effectively run the Ethiopian army out of town.
Yeah, the Tigray People's
It's
Liberation
Liberation
Front.
Front, exactly.
According to Art News here, around 2000, 250,000 people have fled the region since November,
Yes.
after this conflict broke out. And it's getting more and more messy. Eritrea have joined the Prime Minister in the fight against the TPLF.
Yes.
And so.
And that's be and that's be and that's because there's a long-standing dispute between the province of Tigray in Ethiopia and Eritrea, which was a province of Ethiopia and became independent. We're dealing with, as in many of these cases, as in South Sudan, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, that we're dealing with long-standing issues of identity and political loyalty and Often religion is an aside here. People sharing the same religion can still be opposed to each other because of
Oh my goodness.
long-standing economic and
Sorry.
ethnic issues.
Sorry, Northern Ireland, for goodness sake. Oh, it's okay.
Yes.
It's okay. They're both Christians.
Yeah.
It'd be fine. They're
Absolutely. And in fact, you're quite right to point out this is not an issue of, countries in that part of the world or with those religions. This is nothing to do with, the Western right-wing issue of, everything goes back to scary Muslims. This is nothing to do with that whatsoever. These are long-standing ethnic and political arguments within those states, those countries. They're often post-colonial states. Ethiopia was occupied by the Italians in World War II, and they were thrown out by the British, and people who are old like me will remember Emperor Haile Selassie, who was overthrown by a military coup.
Right.
These are long-standing issues. They're not simple, and I think while we have to be very cognizant of the threat to internationally important, these places of outstanding universal value, as UNESCO call them, we don't save the archaeology by saving the archaeology. We save the archaeology by helping promote political solutions, political and economic solutions to these disputes.
And we promote that by understanding. Or
Yeah.
trying to understand, because I have to say, we've done background reading on this, but we're not, we're far, I'm not going about to parachute into Ethiopia and fix
Absolutely
things. That's
not.
not, that's not
No.
what, but at the
Yeah.
very least, this is not as simple as looking at the flag, the religious flag that someone's holding, and saying, oh, the
Absolutely not.
structures will be fine. Yeah, not at all.
Yeah, absolutely not. But the really important thing, is also what people in the political and economic West can do, for want of a better word, is to be very aware of the dangers of looting and trafficking, and making sure that an Ethiopian religious book that crops up in a London sale house, having been the property of an anonymous Swiss collector since the 1960s, has its origin properly researched, and not just have somebody take somebody's word for the provenance.
Yeah. So obviously, I'll have to be very careful for Mrs. Soup's Christmas present this year, won't I? As if I could afford anything like that. But no, I see. Yes. Sorry, that was a bad joke. No, yes, you're right. Yeah, right. Yes. Yeah. Need to keep an eye on this stuff. Thank you guys for watching. Hopefully, we found a little bit of levity where we could this week. In so much of this has been a, this is a, this is a, this is arguably one of the mo this is arguably the most serious issue when it comes to climate change that the species faces. It probably just is, probably even more important than nuclear questions of nuclear proliferation.
And as we saw in the 1980s, the combination of political instability and climate can wreak disaster on places like Ethiopia.
Yeah, absolutely. But nonetheless, hopefully this has been enjoyable. Please do comment below or augment the conversation as you ever do. And if there's anything that you wanted to take a look at next week or in the weeks to come, just send us an email in the email that you can see below, and we'll take a look at it. Until next time, guys, do take care. Thank you for watching. Bye-bye.
This podcast episode has been produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network in collaboration with ArchaeoSoup Productions. Find out more podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.